Welcome to Monsters and Multiclass, your Dungeons & Dragons fix. I'm Eliote.
I'm Jared Warnable.
And I'm Will Meldon.
And on this episode, we are taking a look at Allreal from Icewind Dale. So, yes, this is a very specific adventure boss, but it's a really cool example of a three-phase boss fight. And we kind of wanted to showcase it as inspiration for other bosses. You could also just kind of pluck out of this adventure and use it in other, your own stuff. And ultimately, we just thought it would be kind of a cool and beneficial discussion to dive in.
Yeah, and so this is going to be from a fairly flavor agnostic perspective. We're not going to go super into the lore or anything, but I will just warn that this is going to have spoilers for what is a pretty major boss fight in this campaign. So if you're a player in that campaign in Icewind Dale, then maybe wait until afterwards to watch this one, or just mute it and leave it playing so that way we still get the view and the view time. Like it, leave a comment like, wow, this is really good, but I couldn't actually watch it. And then then come back later. But either way, so the history, at least that's in here, is that this Allreal, the Frost Maiden, is a neutral, evil, lesser god of cold indifference who embodies winter's cruelty. So very much so, this is a lesser god of winter. You can extrapolate as far as you want of a god of ice, a god of cold, of the snow, of winter, however you really want to handle it, can just easily rip that off. I'm not even going to go into kind of the lore here beyond the fact that it is because of Allreal the Frost Maiden that in Icewind Dale, things are very cold. As I understand it, is a pretty cold place usually, but she is making it an eternal winter, and that is just ripe with opportunity to put into your own home game of an area that is plagued with cold for a very long time, and an ice witch, perhaps, however you want to frame Allreal.
Yeah, perpetually dark. Honestly, even the story that Icewind Dale presents could work in any other campaign. Like, you had the other lesser gods as well, and they all got in a big fight and were like destroyed from this realm, and then she came back in a lesser form, and that's what she's doing. That's also why she could actually be a stat block that could be killed, where usually like the gods can't.
Yes, killed at least temporarily, and we'll get to that aspect. But yeah, so we're going to have three distinct stat blocks as Allreal will go through three phases. Everybody is familiar with three-phase boss fights, at the very least from video games, and they're super cool in D&D as well. And this is such a good example of it working well. I honestly would argue probably better than some of the mythic fights from Mythic Odysseys of Theros. So yeah, to start, we're going to talk about Allreal's first form, which is really great art. And there's art for all of these, which I super appreciate, but has this kind of combination of like a goat slash owl slash vulture bird type thing. I don't know. It's got big talons, but I guess owls have talons too.
Yeah, it's a bipedal owl of horns.
Okay, it said that there was like a combination of three things, but I don't remember what all three are.
It's got hooves too.
7 foot tall biped with the head of a snowy owl, black talon, cloven hooves, there you go, and a grayish white wolf fur covering her body from the neck down.
So it uses the word tripartite, and I googled what that means, and it means shared by or involving three parties. So it... Somewhere
where
in
you
there.
See that word?
In its first form description, a cloak and cowl made of pristine white snow conceals much of her tripartite form.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
So there's something else there. Maybe it's humanoid. We'll go with that. Doesn't matter. This is not the important bits. Very cool art. Very just flavorful. And I think a really great concept of what a lesser god would look like in kind of a perceptible form. So... we have a challenge rating 9, armor class of 13, HP of 95, a speed, walking speed of 30 feet, fly speed of 60, has very good stats across the board, except for strength and dex are middling with strength 14, dex of 16, everything else is over 20. We've got saving throws in constitution, which gives her a plus 9, and then wisdom of plus 12, has skills in deception, insight, intimidation, and perception, all over 10, very, very good. And then damage vulnerabilities, which is neat to see in a boss fight, to radiant damage, and then immunities to cold and poison, condition immunities to charmed, exhaustion, frightened, paralyzed, petrified, poison, and stunned, and then senses of dark vision, true sight, and a passive perception of 26. And then last, languages. She knows all of them, and then has telepathy out to 1,000 feet.
And I find it interesting that she's a monstrosity. I would think celestial, and then the vulnerability to radiance, interesting as well, because like radiance is like the damage of the divine.
Yeah,
she is quite literally a lesser god, but it is a weakened form, and
being a god's kind of confusing, right? It doesn't always mean that you give radiance. I mean, Asmodeus is a god, and Asmodeus doesn't do too much radiant damage.
Is Asmodeus considered a god?
I believe so.
I know he has like godlike powers of that level, but...
Man, all right. I don't want to...
That's true, though.
I don't want to get into that. But yes, we'll just... I'll stand by my original statement of it's weird being a god, and I don't think that radiant is always kind of their methodology, and I wouldn't give it to them just because they're a god when this is specifically the god of cold. Why they're vulnerable to radiant, I really don't know.
The sun's radiant.
I got nothing. Yeah.
The sun is radiant. I will take that.
The sun is also hot.
The sun is probably more likely fire damage than radiant damage, or just radiation damage, which isn't radiant. I don't know. This is...
Okay, is radiant damage just radiation?
No.
Oh,
it's
no.
Not. It's holy damage, and we're moving on.
Is that why paladins die so young?
No, it's because they're all idiots. So some things that we'll see on all of these different forms are its passives of being a divine being. So Aurel can't be surprised and can't be changed into another form against her will. And then divine rejuvenation, which works differently for all three of them, but has the same concept. When Aurel drops to 0 HP, her body turns to slush and melts away, and then instantly reappears in her subsequent form in an unoccupied space within 60 feet from where her first form or current form is disappeared. And the initiative count doesn't change, which is nice to throw in because it does make things a little bit easier while running as a DM. That said, if you roll a natural one on initiative for this lesser god, it can be a little bit of a bummer. So
just allow a reroll at that point.
Yeah, maybe just add a little thing into the stat block that says I'm making the initiative 20. Moving on. So yeah, that divine rejuvenation is going to be really neat. We'll see how that kind of plays out as we get into those additional forms, though. For innate spellcasting, we've got the spellcasting ability is charisma and a spell save of 21 with plus 13 to hit with spell attacks, which is a little bit high for a challenge rating 9. Not in a bad way. I think it's just more keeping it consistent throughout all three forms, because calling this thing CR9 is almost disingenuous when you've got two more forms to deal with. Mm-hmm. At will, she has Chromatic Orb, but can only use the cold version of Chromatic Orb, and then Detect Magic and Misty Step. And then twice a day each can control weather, detect thoughts, and cast Ice Storm.
So the At Will Misty Step is awesome. And I think she has no other uses for her bonus action, best I could tell, So basically just a free 30-foot teleportation. Every single turn.
Additional 30-foot teleportation.
Oh, yeah,
because in the legendary actions.
Teleport. Yeah.
But yeah, really good movement from that perspective. The 30 feet walking speed is almost just not showing the whole picture.
Right. The having Chromatic Orb on here is weird because that's also under her actions and it's the exact same thing. I don't know how they did both. It's a little strange. It even calls, says like, you see the actions below for the specifics. And it's like, okay, I don't know why they had to put it there, but.
It's probably just a way of trying to streamline the stat block so you didn't have to look up some of this stuff.
Right.
One less spell to look up because it's just in the stat block is nice. And I don't know. They could have just called it. Really, I guess I agree. It just didn't need to be a spell. It could have just been an action called Cold Orb of Orb of Frost, and
right,
problem solved. It doesn't need to be a spell.
Yeah, it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah, I guess the only difference is it can be counterspelled.
Yeah.
Then control weather is a really neat spell, but I don't know if it matters too much for this fight, because control weather just it's a 10-minute casting time, and then it lasts for 8 hours. I think control weather is basically just kind of on by default when you are.
It's what she does. That's right. Like the whole thing. She's turning the area into perpetual winter and darkness. It's like,
yeah,
it's the god of winter. It's like that's controlling weather's her thing.
And she's just going to make it super hot for no reason.
Right.
So a little pointless to even put it on there, but whatever. It's sure. on there.
Yeah, it doesn't like hurt anything.
No. And Ice Storm is, I'd say, okay for it being a fourth level spell and there not being anything in here to cast it outside of a full action. I don't know how often it's going to get used. I don't really love Ice Storm as a whole. But
it's
with
not a lot of damage.
No. And she can't officially cast it on her own area because she would take bludgeoning damage. Wouldn't take the cold damage. So maybe,
right,
you know, it's not that bad and you just kind of ignore it, but definitely a little bit out of place.
Yeah, it's a 20-foot radius, 40-foot cylinder, dexterity saving throw, which for her is a DC 21, so that's high.
Yeah.
2d8 bludgeoning damage and 46 cold damage on a fail. And then the area is difficult terrain until the end of your next turn. Like, it's not an amazing spell. It's fourth level, so for PCs, that's a high commitment. And for a boss like this, their entire action is a very high commitment for very middling damage.
Yeah. So honestly,
but her attacks are not that great either, which I know we didn't get to, so maybe it's worth it.
Great. So then we do have some legendary resistances. Twice a day in this form, it specifies. So that's important to note that basically each form gets its own pool of legendary resistances. Has magic resistance, so advantage on saving throws against spells and other magical effects. And then, of course, because this is a lesser god, unusual nature. So Arl does not require air, food, drink, or sleep. For the actions, we've got a multi-attack where Arl can attack twice with her talons. A talon is a melee weapon attack, +7 to hit, reach of 5 feet, one target, does 1d8 +3 piercing damage, and then 1d6 cold damage. So, yeah, not really that much. Also has Touch of Frost, which didn't need to be codified as a spell, so I don't know. has +13 to hit, so a little more likely.
Oh, yeah, that's chill touch. Not chill touch.
I don't know what it is, to be honest. It's
shocking grasp, but cold damage.
Yep, that's right. So then does 3d8 cold damage, and the target can't take reaction until the start of its next turn. So yeah, you're spot on. It is shocking grasp, but cold damage. Then we have Chromatic Orb, which is a rain spell attack. +13 to hit, range of 90 feet, and does 3d8 cold damage. So honestly, yeah, for the damage wise, it's nothing too absurd out the gate here. I mean, 13 damage with your action, maybe we undersold Ice Storm a little bit, because that is a pretty big difference between average of 13 damage and, I don't even know what Ice Storm would be, but it would be a little bit higher at least.
Yeah, that 2d8 +46, yeah. Yeah, the damage isn't high, but I think it's where it needs to be for this fight.
Yeah.
Because it's phase one and there's two more. And that's one of the aspects I really liked about how they handle this. I mean, there are legendary and we'll get to those, but they don't change anything up too much. So you're going to come and fight this, and I'm sure there's a big build up, especially if you like playing Icewind Dale, but if you just like put this fight in any other thing, like the do big build up. Like this is the ever present threat that you are gearing up towards trying to get to and kill. And so you finally get to it, and that's already dramatic, and there's a lot of tension. And it's gonna be this kind of slow, not too difficult boss. Like it's this hunched over owl creature who's not crazy threatening, does some damage enough to weaken your party a bit and use up some resources, but nothing crazy. And especially if the party just goes all out, just assuming this is just going to be insane, and they blow all their high spell slots,
yep,
and like just destroy this form. So I think it's kind of exactly where it needs to be. I know I'm often one to really complain about low damage, but they just don't feel like a threat and it's not going to do much, but because there's two more forms. No, I would not put this any higher.
The only time where it could be a problem is if you don't just make the initiative count high, because this very well could get destroyed in a single turn if she rolls a one on her initiative roll. And you don't want this to be a nothing fight. Like, even just having one turn can shake things up. I mean, yeah, she'd be able to do a Talon attack or a Touch of Frost and maybe teleport, but she doesn't have any defensive abilities that would allow her to make it to her turn. So just, I don't know. I think that's important to keep in mind, because even though it is, I agree, in a good spot, because this is one of three fights, you can't make it that forgettable where they just get ripped through in one turn.
Sure. Yeah, that's kind of true of all bosses. Just allow yourself to fudge the initiative a bit.
I need to learn that lesson myself. I've had too many times where I'm just like, this is it, boss fight, and then they get like a five on initiative, and I'm like, huh, that makes things a lot worse. That was bad. Ooh, I got an idea. Burning legendary resistances on initiative. Get a poor initiative, use a legendary resistance. That way it's like middle, little bit of balance to it.
I don't know. For these bosses, these like big bosses, I would just put it high. See what the party rolls, and like, if anyone rolled like really, really high, let them go before, and then like stick them in after.
LEOD fudges rolls. You heard it here first.
Yes. Yeah. As a DM. I mean, I don't cheat as a player, but yes, as a DM.
I try to avoid it when I can. If I can make it like a mechanical thing, I will, but it's all just a matter of if you prepared it before or at the start of the fight. Legendary action. So we've got standard legendary action set up here, has three legendary actions, and then has talons, can attack once with her talons, teleport, can teleport to an unoccupied space you can see within 30 feet, and then touch of frost, which costs two actions, where she uses her touch of frost. So nothing too wild in terms of legendary actions.
They're kind of boring. I would like to see more interesting. I understand not going strong stuff, but just more flavorful.
Yeah, I guess to touch on what I was talking about is I'd like to see just one defensive ability, just to maybe even, it'd be like a reaction. I was going to say like when hit, being able to teleport instead of like a melee attack is going to be really devastating, because I just see with the vulnerability to damage, this fight with a paladin, you have to be very careful. Because you talked about, you know, dumping spell slots right at the start here. Well, that one is going to be pretty darn effective. If the paladin runs up and dumps a third level smite into this first form, they might just skip it entirely.
Yeah, it would be a lot. I mean, it's not going to skip it, but
it can do probably half of her HP easily in a hit. And that's something that you want to be wary of. Right. So either way, I just could see one maybe defensive action on the legendary actions, to make this a little, maybe last a round longer. Cause this lasting one round.
How about just shield twice a day and it's ice themed?
Yep. Ice shield.
Okay.
Fine. Sure.
That's perfect.
That could probably just be added as a spell in general. And then you don't have to touch the legendary actions at all.
No, you have to make sure everybody knows it's not shield. It's ice shield, but it's not ice shield. It's an ice shield.
Because there's a spell called ice shield. Or is it fire shield that can be also ice?
Yeah.
All right. Either way, that's first form. I think it's pretty straightforward. Will be a fairly quick fight, but should be good for kind of gearing things up for the second form after she melts to her puddle.
Yeah, and setting a kind of initial tone. Keep everything you do reserved a bit as the DM. That'll be my suggestion. If you use music, maybe using Bardley and using M&M 50 to get 50% off. That's a free one. A free plug. It's not really great. It's great for us, not for the audience, but...
you killed it.
Go with something really subdued. Yeah, I lost my train of thought there. Yeah, go with something kind of quiet and subdued. and have like when they finally enter the lair, she's busied with something else and kind of stands and turns around and the fight starts. It's nothing big. It's nothing dramatic. It's going to have this weird feeling, and I think that will unsettle the players. And then it also kind of hint that there's probably more coming, which I think they'll need to have a sense of so they don't literally blow all of their like once a day high level spells on this.
Yeah, I guess. It depends on what those high level spells are, right? Because if they're just using like a single target damage spell at a really high level, you know, they use it. It's whatever. But most high level right. spells that are going to be of value are going to continue being of value into the second phase because they're concentration or whatever. You know, so just don't do like the thing where you say, oh, the fight's over. And they're like, OK, well, I take down the polymorph because we don't want to have a giant monkey anymore. And then, oh, second form started. Ha, you wasted your high level spell. Gotcha.
Right.
So just let anything they're concentrating on continue on into the second form.
Well, it depends what it is. Not a debuff. Not an effect that's on.
Oh, yes.
All real. Like if that's it's a good spell. Point. That's a debuff. That's a concentration on all real. I think that needs to end when the first form dies.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, it hits okay. 0 HP. She collapses. That's pretty rules is written. Pretty obvious what would happen. It ends.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. You can only do so much because you don't want to spoil the fact that like there's a second or even a third form. So to some extent, if they use it, they use it. I mean, maybe.
Yeah, I would just be worried about them not surviving it. Because that's kind of like the thing, like, all right, save the resources fighting to her. Like, here she is, like, time to unload. And then it's like, okay, now they have nothing left to actually survive the rest of the fights. And, like, that's kind of like a weird meta place, like, metagaming place, where it's, like, the player knowing how usually encounter structures go and, like, yeah. how, like, dungeon design goes and knowing when it's probably okay to really unload.
Here's
and then, like... that's subverting it and I was like, oh shit, I got nothing left.
Yeah, so I don't think that would be a problem because for anyone who knows how boss fights go, they know that there's legendary resistances, and with Auril the first form only having two legendary resistances, I don't think she will live long enough to burn through those and then waste a high level spell. I think in most scenarios, she's going to die from HP loss before the legendary resistances are both used, especially because she has advantage on magic. So magic effects, you know, you'll know that right away, or probably know that right away that she has advantage. So I think spellcasters will be a little bit nervous to target her anyways. But that's like getting into a level of meta that it depends on your players. It really does. Right. All right, so getting into the second form, when Auril rises up, she is this like massive ice queen now, and it is really cool.
Lady Ice Kiss,
that's good. Or the Brittle Maiden, which yeah. is like not really accurate for like she doesn't seem very, very brittle, but a 10-foot tall woman, let's see, of fearsome aspect made entirely of ice and frost. Her eyes burn with a cold blue light and a thin cloak of mist forms around her. Blades of ice grow out of her body at odd angles, breaking off before they get too long. When she moves, her body crackles. It is cool. I like yeah, this one.
And this is when you amp up the music, by the way.
Yes.
Something more. And like, you got to find that sweet spot where it sounds like really epic. And it's like, given the sense this is all right, a second and final form, but have one more song to play for the third form that can increase it even more. But you know, there's that sweet spot somewhere out there.
Yeah, that's going to be tough to find, but but this is a boss fight that you're like, you should prepare for, that you should be yes. like ready to put that work in. So we have the challenge rating 10 and armor class of 16, HP of 136, speed of 30 and no fly speed here. Strength is +3, dex +3, con +5, intelligence +7, wisdom +8, charisma +9. Most of that is the same, but it's a little bit better than the last one. Same saving throws, same skills. Now has a damage vulnerability to fire. So even if the party figured out before that Radiant was working, that goes away, which I think is pretty darn neat.
I would have loved to see a kind of switch where now they're immune to Radiant. I get why they didn't, but that would have been neat. I would have liked that.
Yeah. I think I just had a thought as to why the first form's vulnerable to radiant as well. Something to do with being a shape changer in this form. Like, that comes up a lot when a lot of things that
are
shape
changers.
Man, I went
the exact opposite way. I was like, it's an owl. Owls only come out at night because they're vulnerable to the sun.
I like that idea too.
Okay.
Damage immunities, cold and poison, no change there, no change to condition immunities. Honestly, I'm going to skip past all this because it's all the same. Getting to what is different, the actions. Actions are different. Everything else so far is more or less the same.
Yeah. She does regain her legendary resistances.
Yes. Just
to re-mention that.
Has multi-attack, so attacks twice with her Ice Morning Star and hurls 3 ice darts. So that's already telling you. Yeah, so it's already telling you that she is making weapons out of her ice body and like pulling out ice darts and throwing them and creating an Ice Morning Star. Like, oh, that's that's good. That's good stuff. The Ice Morning Star is a +7 to hit, reach of 5 feet, 1 target, of course, and does 1d8 +3 piercing damage plus 2d8 cold damage. And then the ice darts are basically like daggers, have 20-60 range, also +7 to hit, do 1d4 +3 piercing damage, and then 1d6 cold damage. So nothing too crazy from a damage perspective, but it's pretty consistent damage. Just like being able to attack 3 times is nice. The Cone of Cold is the next ability and didn't need to be put in as a spell. And recharges after a short or long rest. Arl causes a magical blast of cold air to erupt from her hand. Each creature in a 60-foot cone must make a DC 21 con saving throw or take 8d8 cold damage, average of 36, on a failed save, or half as much on a successful stave.
So Cone of Cold's great. Strong AoE. Happy to see it here. That's going to be like a big kind of shock of damage to the party.
Yep, good way to start the second phase, to basically say, like, not messing around here. Mm-hmm. Then we have Create Ice Method, which she can do 3 times a day. She breaks off an icicle from her body and hurls it into an unoccupied space within 20 feet of her, where it magically transforms into an ice method. And the ice method immediately acts after Arl's initiative and obeys her commands.
So I don't like how that's a whole action.
It's only there so it can be a legendary action.
Yeah.
Which they could have just left it right there.
Just start her with some. Like, as she transforms, some ice flies out, crashes into the ground, and turns into an ice method.
I'm going to agree with you.
Because they're only towns rated 1/2.
Yeah, I'm going to totally agree with you.
Yeah, they have AC 11, 21 health. But they have a death burst, which is cool. They like explode when they die and do some damage. But like their attacks don't do much.
Average, but it's so much cooler to like think of her coming back in and like kind of just having that like the setup phase where she's, you know, pulling an ice morning star off of her body and like creating these, you know, ice flecks, and boom, they turn into ice mephits, and now you're fighting the second form plus 3 ice mephits just right out the gate. It's just more interesting. I don't know. I don't like the setup throughout aspect.
Yeah, I agree.
Then we have Ice Stasis, and this is a recharge ability on 5 or 6. Arl magically creates a gem-sized ice crystal that hovers in a space within 5 feet of her, then targets a creature within 60 feet of the crystal. The target must succeed on a DC 21 charisma saving throw or become trapped in the crystal, which is immovable. If the saving throw succeeds, the crystal shatters, and then a creature trapped in the crystal is stunned, has total cover against attacks and other effects outside of the crystal, and takes 66 cold damage at the start of each of its turns. The creature can repeat the saving throw at the end of each of its turns, freeing itself on a success. And the creature is also freed if the crystal is destroyed, which is a tiny object with an AC of 18, 9 HP, and immunity to all damage except for fire. The freed creature appears in an unoccupied space of its choice within 30 feet of the shattered crystal. That last sentence is a little bit weird, but maybe to go through this one at a time. DC 21 charisma saving throw is terrifying.
Yes, a lot of people have very low charisma. There's a lot of characters who cannot pass this. If you don't have a plus, where if you have 8 charisma, no proficiency bonus, you're going to have a negative. It is impossible for you to pass that save.
Yep. And the person most likely to be able to do fire damage consistently is like your casters. And unless you have, you know, a sorcerer or charisma caster, this could be very, very detrimental for them.
Yes. Yeah. And an intelligence of 24, I would say she's smart enough to know to target the casters with this, because they also don't really have the HP to withstand this. The 66 every turn, like, that's a lot.
Yeah, 21 on average.
Right. Yeah, and then your fighters can't really, like, do anything.
They can pull out a torch.
I guess they can. I don't know how much damage that does.
There's rules for it. I think it is one. I think you're right. So that'd be nine turns. God. Or do they have to, if they get multi-attack, they can maybe do two damage.
Fighter, I mean, three probably at this level, but actually it's only challenge rating 10, maybe not.
The expectation in the book is that you're fighting this around level 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I think 8 actually is the specific one, but it's a little fuzzy. Right. Yeah, so definitely something to keep in mind is if you do only have like one player who can do fire damage and it is the wizard and they've got a -1 to their charisma, they're going to fail this. Even if they get a natural 20, even if they have a 10 charisma, they are failing this every time. And you maybe have some items that can do some fire damage, just enough to maybe break this. Something to keep in mind.
Right. And also, your party's not going to necessarily know it's immune to everything except for fire.
Yeah.
So waste some attacks, probably. Some cool moments, though, like the raging barbarian with their two-handed maul coming down hard on it and just dead stop and bouncing off as if they, like, you know, hit a giant boulder or something. And it's just like tiny little diamond. And like nothing happening.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And a recharge of 5 or 6, like, you can have more than one of these going. It's not concentration.
Oh, that's a very good point. That's its own TPK.
It's a scary one. Yeah, you just got... That's where you get in that weird points. All right, as the DM, do you be really, really cautious and careful with it? Or because this is, like, the big fight, you're literally fighting a god, just, like, go all out.
I think it's just a matter of, like I was saying, of having tools in their tool belt to deal with this, even just some oil that they can throw on the ice and burn, and it does, I don't know, 1d6 damage per round or something. Just a way to manage it is, I think, what's necessary here. And then you can be as mean as you want.
Right.
But like all recharge abilities, we talk about telecasting them. Is that the right word there? Telegraphing them. That's the word.
Telegraphing.
Yeah, where you like make it known kind of beforehand that like, oh, the ice stasis is coming back. You know, she pulls off a tiny little crystal and holds it in her hand. And like you see her imbue energy into the crystal. And that's kind of the knowledge that, hey, next turn, she's tossing the ice stasis.
Sure. Except for raw, it's the same turn. You roll at the beginning of their turn and then they could use it that same turn.
Usually when I have a recharge ability like that, I take them recharging it as the time to show that they're recharging.
Okay.
So yeah, that would be the time to telegraph it. And then next turn you would use it.
It doesn't matter. Better. It's like,
no,
oh, it doesn't. I'm going to do the ice stasis. It's like, well, I mean, we can't do anything. We're going to be in the crystal.
You can get far away. I don't know if they'd know that. They wouldn't know that. Maybe it means the paladin needs to move to the wizard to give them a bonus to their charisma saving throw to give them a chance to get out of it. I don't know. It lets you prepare. Are you going to absolutely crush this because you know what to do? Probably not. But the first time is a gimme because they're not going to know what ice stasis is. They're not going to know how to deal with it. But once they figure that out, I think letting them know that it's coming might give them a couple of ideas of how to interact with it. Or they don't, and they're screwed. In which case, sorry. I guess we didn't really consider the fact that you don't have any person in the party that can deal fire damage.
Is there any way to get yourself immunity to the stun condition?
Freedom of movement? Is that immune to stun?
I don't think so.
Now I gotta look.
Because if so, that could be an interesting interaction.
While we're looking this up, make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you're enjoying, and let us know how you would use this creature, or if you fought her in your campaign. Freedom of movement does not get rid of stunned or remove the ability to be stunned.
Yeah, nothing's coming to mind. So if there's some way to do that, that'll be like you get trapped in it, but you still have your actions. Could still attack it from the inside. Just some way to.
Yeah, that could be something. Okay, yeah, not even Greater Restoration is going to help there.
No.
Hmm. Okay, there's probably something, but nothing that's coming to mind. Great, so then we do get into the legendary actions. So pretty standard fare here of three legendary actions. Can either attack, which would allow her to either use the Morning Star or the Ice Dart. Yeah, because it's one weapon attack. Then we have Ice Flurry, where each creature within 30 feet of Arl takes 2d4 piercing damage from swirling ice, and non-magical open flames in that area are extinguished, which would be really annoying if your only method was using a torch or oil to like do that fire damage, and then she just whoop, all of that goes out.
Sure. Other than that, though, it's a pretty bad legendary action.
Yeah, 2d4 piercing damage is
like that's
nothing.
So low.
Yeah.
For two actions.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's like the ice stasis is, and the cone of cold are both terrifying, but they're being very careful about too much damage. And I think that's probably for the best. Again, it's a three phase boss fight. Like we're not done yet. So when attacking a level 8 party or so, doing what's she got? 7 plus 9, like I guess that'd be 32 damage per round just with the Ice Morning Star, plus any legendary action she uses for that. That can be a lot of damage at those levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I did 32 damage to you all right now at level 7, that's for some of you that's over bad. Half your HP.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay that Ice Flurry sucks in terms of damage. It's just like a general, like, hey, don't get too close punishment.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
The other thing that sucks is because it does piercing damage, if you have, like, for whatever reason, this little horde of ice mephits that you're having fun with, they're going to get blasted by it, too. If they'd made it cold...
Ooh, that's a good point.
Your ice mephits would shug it up, but it's like, no, you're blasting them. I mean, the nice thing is it's so little damage, it doesn't matter, but we're back at the...
Well...
What's going on here?
For them, it almost matters more. They have 21 HP, so that probably might kill them in a turn or two.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's not too much. And honestly, if she kills her ice mephits after three rounds, then that's funny. So it's fine. They should probably know to stay more than 30 feet back. And I would use them as they're the backliners. Like they're going into the backline of your party, the spellcasters, and annoying them in a good way by being near them, forcing the spellcasters to use their movement to try and disengage or use spells to get away from them. Because even if the ice mephits die next to them, Death Burst is a thing too. And it's not a lot of damage, but again, we're just talking about keeping up this constant tension that comes from a boss fight, and having those ice mephits out to do that to the spellcasters is going to add a lot, even if they're not adding a ton of, you know, danger in particular. Right. Which then brings us to that splinter ability. This is where it costs three actions to bring out one of these ice mephits, or cause one of the ice mephits she can see within 60 feet of her to explode and die. A mephit that dies in this way does not use its death burst. Instead, each creature within 10 feet of the exploding mephit must succeed on a DC 21 dex saving throw or take 3d8 piercing damage on a failed save or half as much on a successful one.
That's cool. I like that a lot. Little AoE bombs that move around, and it's for this level, and compared to what else she does, it's pretty good damage.
Yeah. Yeah. And the 10-foot radius can be pretty damaging. I mean, that's can potentially get two or three of your players, and 21 dex save. I mean, that's yeah, right. This is dangerous. So another reason why I'm a fan of making the ice mephits already out, because with 136 HP, it takes a while to set these things up and there's no guarantee she'll be around.
Yeah.
I'm curious how how you think players would adjust to the fire vulnerability. Do you think they'd pick up on there being a change? Do you think people would try to use fire after maybe trying it in the first phase and it not being any different?
She's a giant ice humanoid. Yes, people are going to assume, let's try fire.
Good. To me, that's kind of cool if this comes up. It makes her play out better because she can use that ice stasis on whoever does the fire damage, gives a target. And yeah, I guess I hope that a player would try to use fire in some fashion. So that's phase two. Any other thoughts on the phase two fight here?
No, I'm good to go on phase three.
Okay,
to reiterate that ice stasis is, you just have to be so freaking careful with that because this fight is so dependent on fire damage because of that complete immunity to everything else. So
Here's actually one question about that too. If somebody is stuck in the ice stasis and then she dies, do they get freed?
I assume.
I think the
ability is gone. So it's like, no,
okay.
No, it bugs out and they're stuck forever and they have to restart the game.
Obviously not, but I guess that would be the smart way to handle it, especially if the players don't have a way of freeing that person from the ice stasis. Is just say second form's gone and the ice stasis breaks. But that is not codified in here. So that's important to, I guess, discuss, or
consider beforehand.
Yes. Because I think rules as written, I don't know about rules as intended, to me it would keep going. There's no reason why it would stop just because she dies. It talks about how to end it. It gives the conditions for ending it, and it's breaking it, or they succeed on the saving throw. And it's not concentration.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that's intended, but as written, yeah. I think you're right.
Great. So then we get into the third form, where she, once again, I think, does it give it a description? And does she turn into a puddle? She collapses into shards of ice, whereupon Auril instantly reappears in her third form, which is a giant, floating, glowing block of ice.
It's pretty small.
You're right.
It's small. Yeah.
You're right, actually. It is pretty small. It's a 3-foot diameter ice diamond.
Ice diamond, yeah.
Yeah. Containing the god's divine spark. Sorry.
It's known as Winter's Womb, or the Queen of Frozen Tears.
All really cool names. I want to have, like, even one cool name, like one cool nickname, but she gets like six. For each form, she gets two nicknames. That's not fair.
Does the first form have one?
In her first form,
Cold Crone.
Cold Crone. She gets five then, and she gets her regular name. So
that is the Lady Ice Kiss or Brittle Maiden. And then, Winter's Womb and Queen of Frozen Tears.
This is going to be the longest title we've ever had. So we're like, Auril, the Winter's Womb, or Queen of Frozen Tears, or this, or this. Just keep going.
Right.
But we won't do that. So for a stat block, we've got a challenge rating 11 now. So still, just, small incremental increases here. Armor class of 19, HP of 136, and then a fly speed of 30, and it has the hover ability. Strength goes down to 1, dexterity to 12, and then everything else after is equivalent or just really good. It's over 20. Damage vulnerability shifts once again from fire now to thunder damage. And I love that. I love that so much.
And that one is not obvious.
No.
Vulnerability to fire in the ice lady form makes sense. And then this one, you would think, oh, still fire. Like, she's an ice dagger now. Like an ice diamond.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Thunder.
More of a crystal, actually. Only big change here is that for the senses, she gets blind sight now. So, or is it true sight? Oh, what changes?
Both.
Okay, she already had true sight, so she gains blind sight. I don't think that really matters when you already have true sight. At all. True sight's fine. That's
kinda. I mean, true sight, like, it's not a sight. Like, it allows you to see in normal magical darkness, see invisible creatures and objects, automatically detect visual illusions, succeed on saving throws against them, and perceive the original form of shapeshifters or creatures transformed by magic. And they can see to the ethereal plane. Technically, it's like just like a regular ass person standing there. They're blind too. Because they have no other form of sight. That's why they give a blind sight.
It specifically says, a monster with true sight can, out to a specific range, see in normal and magical darkness, comma, see invisible creatures and objects, comma. That's saying, like, in addition, it can do those things. Okay. So I don't think
about blind sight then, yeah.
I don't know what the difference is. Right, but it doesn't need eyes. It has true sight. We've had this debate before. I'm almost positive, but it doesn't matter.
That sounds familiar.
So moving on, this is the last of her forms, but she does have divine resurrection. And this is one that, you know, if it makes sense in your game, great. But when she drops to zero.
Let's talk about that at the end. Let's go through the stat block, then explain what happens when you kill her.
Ooh, okay. That's a special surprise for later. She does gain.
We got to build a narrative here.
She does gain a frigid aura. So long as Aurel has at least one HP in this form, each creature within 10 feet of her takes 10 cold damage at the start of each of her turns. That definitely changes things up. It's not a ton of damage, but at this point, you're probably getting on the lower side of HP, and that's pretty scary.
And I mean, at this level, 10 is a decent amount to just automatic damage. I always love the auras.
I hope
neat tactical choice to the fight.
I do hope that somebody in the party has cold resistance just like getting to this fight, but maybe you don't, and this is very dangerous. Then we have one legendary resistance in this form, so she does regain only a single legendary resistance. The rest stays the same. Then we have actions. Has multi-attack. Aurel uses Polar Ray twice. So Polar Ray is a ranged spell attack, plus 13 to hit, range of 120 feet, and does 46 cold damage, which I think is just... No, not Scorching Ray. Nope, it's just Polar Ray. That's all. And then we have Blizzard Veil, which is also an action. Aurel creates a magical blizzard in a 30-foot radius sphere centered on herself. The area within the sphere is heavily obscured, and the sphere moves with Aurel. The effect lasts until Aurel drops it to zero... Sorry, until Aurel drops to zero HP in this form, until she chooses to end the effect, no action required, or until her concentration is broken, as if concentrating on a spell. So let's talk about that one.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. It's heavily obscured is basically meaning anyone in it is blind. She's obviously not. She has true sight and blind sight, so it doesn't matter. And I see no reason to not almost always have it up. I would spawn her in the third form with it. This ice diamond forms and floats in the air, and the swirling blizzard picks up around her and obscures the area, and that's the start of the fight. Just like with like starting off Ice Methods from the last one.
Yeah.
Having to wait for her initiative and take her entire action to make that happen feels a little silly, not super great.
It holds it stops the momentum a little too much. The new form part is already like super cool. And if the super cool first turn is preparing for the next turn, it's just not that exciting. So I'm with you.
Right. And so she could have that on, sit in the middle of it, be basically anybody outside of it. No, unless anyone has like blind sight, basically, or true sight, just a way to see through it, they cannot see her. So they can't target her of any spells that require, you know, a creature you could see. And any attacks will have disadvantage, and all of her attacks will have advantage because she could see. So she could sit in the middle, taking her Polar Ray shots from it, get an advantage on all of those, doing an average of 28 damage a turn from a place where no one could see her.
Yeah.
That's scary. Like, it's not like... It's very D&D scary.
That's the most Ellie thing you've ever said. I don't know why I can't, like, explain that any further, but go ahead. Go ahead.
If this was, like, if you're trying to picture this as, like, the big end third form boss fight in a video game, think of, like, Dark Souls or something, and it's, like, the big bombastic thing that happens in this third form as the music picks up and everything falling around is, like, yeah, if you get too close, you can't see her, and they're just going to, like, take pot shots at you. Like in a video game, that's not going to play really well, but in D&D, the entire party is going to be kind of terrified about shit. What do we do? Because we're already hurting. We don't really have a good way to counter that. I guess we could run in and try and hope we hit her. They don't know it's concentration. So she has plus 9 to those checks. Anyways, yeah, it's like in like a tabletop RPG in D&D, it's a very, very frightening encounter. It does not work in any other medium.
No, I agree. And the visual of it is really neat as well. Just that idea of like, you can kind of barely at the start see this like floating crystal, but then the crystal just disappears and all you see is a snowstorm, a sphere of wind and snow and ice. And that's like, that's it. And there's just those polar rays just shooting out of it. Just this heavy energy of cold, embodied cold, just hitting you directly as you can't even see where it's coming from. Ah, man, it's
plus 13 to hit with advantage.
It's hitting
most of those hit. And as mentioned, like this is, you're going to be whittled down at this point in this fight. And that 14 average damage per hit is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I talked about the level that you're probably going to be fighting this in Icewind Dale. I might have gotten that off by a level or two, but this would still be a good fight, I think, up to level 10, 12. I mean, this final one is nothing to mess with.
No.
Because even when you try and hit it, 19 AC. The only way that you're really going to just hit this and kind of get something across is casting AoE spells near it, right? Because that you don't really have to see the specific spot as long as they have that.
It depends. A lot of them say choose a point you could see.
Could you do it on like the edge of the veil?
If it's big enough, yeah. It'll go through.
So if you have like a 30-foot radius, which is pretty darn big.
Yeah.
Or like a moonbeam that you just start like moving through, like hoping that you find her.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would allow, obviously, let players get creative.
Yeah, but that's fun creative to me, because that's like, like, what spells do we have that can just, that don't rely on seeing it to that extent? Because they'll see it's a 30-foot radius, and that's pretty wide.
Yeah, and she does have magic resistance, don't forget that. So advantage on all those saving throws anyways.
Yeah, oh man, even a natural one, you have to do more than 20 damage on that hit in order to push a concentration check of meaning. Because she can get a natural one on her concentration checks and pass anything that is not breaking that threshold.
Right.
So I guess, you know, 20? Yeah, because it's half. So yeah, you have to do 22 damage minimum in an attack to force a concentration check. That would still fail on like a roll of a 2. Or only on a 2. Ooh, this is brutal. You're probably dealing with the Blizzard Veil the entire fight.
Probably.
Okay, so then we do get to the legendary actions, which we've got a couple more interesting ones here. Not Polar Ray. I mean, that one's pretty straightforward. Takes one action. Arl uses Polar Ray. Great. Then we have Intensify Aura. This costs 2 actions. The Frigid Aura deals an extra 10 cold damage until the start of her next turn. Until the end of her next turn. That's each creature within 10 feet takes 10 cold damage. Now they're taking 20 cold damage,
which is a big jump at this level.
Yeah. And then we have Blinding Gleam. So this costs 2 actions. Arl's form flares with a blue light. Each creature that can see Arl and is within 10 feet of her must succeed on a DC 17 wisdom saving throw or be blinded by Arl's magical gleam for 1 minute. They can repeat the saving throw at the end of each of its turns, ending the effect on itself on a success.
That one feels silly.
What's the
point? I guess unless if the veil goes down, you can still get people blinded. That's the only reason I can see that, because otherwise her being in the middle of her veil is effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
Without a save, it just happens.
Yeah, this is interesting.
Okay. The fighter barrels through and starts hacking like crazy and gets lucky and lands hits and breaks concentration and Blizzard Veil drops. That's the end of fighter's turn and the spark flares up in this blinding light. Now that it's revealed, potentially blinding everybody.
Not everybody, within 10 feet.
Yeah, within 10 feet, yeah. It's like,
it's an oh shit button.
It's like a lesser version of Blizzard Veil. They got it down, and so like, all right, here's, just so, yeah, just, I don't know. keep something happen. Consolation that's, prize for all real.
that's fine. And it's going to be hard enough to drop the Blizzard Veil that I really doubt this is going to come up very often. But if it does, as I said, it gives her an extra turn to kind of recuperate a little bit, maybe.
Right.
So I'm fine with it. It's just not super exciting. I think most of the time the Intensify Aura is going to be used if somebody's that close. Otherwise, Polar Rays, which just means that she might be doing five of those per round instead of just two. And that by itself is pretty darn scary. So we're now getting into like 70 average damage per round, something like that. 70, 80.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot.
It is a lot. And how do we kill her? So when Arl drops to zero HP, this is the Divine Resurrection, her crystalline form shatters and her divine spark vanishes. She is dead until the next winter solstice, when she reappears at full health in a cold, remote location of her choosing. This is a god. You're not just going to kill them because you destroyed their avatar. You destroyed their avatar and caused a mild inconvenience for them.
Almost. It is a lesser god, though.
True.
And it doesn't say it in the stat block, but in the flavor text and descriptions, it goes on to say, as long as there is still at least one worshiper of her, this will happen. If there is none, then she is dead for good.
Ooh. Now that sounds like a follow-up quest.
Right?
Time to find all the worshippers.
Or beforehand to prepare, but yeah.
Hey, buddy, what's your favorite season? Oh, it's got to be winter. Not taking any chances.
So a lesser god like this that's causing a bunch of problems, any of her worshippers, it's going to be a cult. So it's more about hunting down, exterminating a cult.
Which or is converting like them.
Sure, yeah. Okay, there you go. There's the moral dilemmas. Do you just kill them outright? Or you convert them, but risk, like, maybe they go back and start worshiping and she comes back anyways, or they're lying to you and you didn't pick up on it. But, I mean, that's a whole campaign arc.
Yeah.
And take you from, like, level 1 to 10, where you can then realistically fight her. Like, you set out with the goal, like, all right, I'm going to kill the god of winter, but I'm level 1. And, yeah, you get the lore drop at the beginning about how if any worshippers will revive her. And so, you know, I was like, all right, I can't do that now, but let's start dismantling that. Let's start doing what we can as we gain in power, in strength, and find information we can as we wipe her worshippers from the face of the planet.
Man, that's like a dark start.
Sure.
To a story. I mean, I'm grappling with that as we go, because is worshiping a god of winter by itself, like, is she bad enough to justify wiping out potentially hundreds, thousands of people who worship her? Is she that evil? I know she's making an area.
So I don't think it's going to be that many. I say this is like a lesser god who's plunging an entire region of the world into perpetual winter and darkness, starving out everybody, killing crops. People who worship her are going to be cultists hoping to gain power. That's how I would play it.
Sure.
This is not like a god who has temples set up and you just kind of like have disagreements on their tenets or something.
The women and children too. Like, oh god. Yeah, it's
like you need to wipe out her cult.
I guess it's just establishing that. Like establishing any villain that you don't want to have a moral quandary over. Just, you need to make them evil. You need to make it kind of across the board. Yes, they're evil. Yes, this is okay. Unless you want it to be that type of very difficult moral question campaign.
Yeah. Well, I do like that of converting them, convincing the cultists this is not a good path.
Right.
You need to turn away. And then there's kind of like that implied threat. It's like, we're going to kill you if you don't. And then you do get into that tricky situation. Like, do we trust them? Or is it just under the threat of us being here? And as soon as we leave, they're going to do it again. And then like, all of this is for naught. Because if just one of them will worship her again, by the time the winter solstice comes back, she returns. Right.
That's fun. Yeah. I like it. That's good, like, drama. Said,
whole campaign. It's an excuse and a reason to get the party across the entire region of a world, going from village to village, interacting with side quests, everything.
And to kind of wrap up the stat block conversation, there's one small piece that's the layer actions. She does have those as well. Right. And she gets them anytime she's on her island. So that could be really anywhere you're fighting her. She's going to have access to these layer actions and can change up the fight a lot, actually. So the first one is Arl instantly knows the locations and health of all other creatures on the island. She knows how much damage each of these creatures have taken, how many levels of exhaustion they have, and what conditions are affecting them currently. So it's basically giving you free rein as DM to metagame as much as you need to like mm-hmm. be smart about how you're playing out the fight. So pretty like much, that yeah. piece. The Arl next one, Arl instantly teleports to any location on the island. If the space she chooses as her destination is already occupied, then she appears next to it. That one I think is probably the most important of these, because this happens on initiative count 20. If she's in a bad situation, she can just leave to another part of the island.
Yeah, or even just teleport around the battle as yeah. needed.
Yeah, on a small scale, kind of earlier on, teleporting around the battle. But later on, I mean, I just don't see, and this is something your party will have to grapple with, pun not entirely intended, but we'll have to figure out how to keep her in one position and to not teleport away. And I honestly don't know how you can shut down a layer action like that.
That might come in how you roleplay. It does give tips about who she is. Mm-hmm. And she is a god, a lesser god, but a god. Very arrogant, self-assured. Sees this stuff as more of an inconvenience and knows she'll come back. And that's so true. She just doesn't do it. She'll maybe use it pre-combat to get around the island and during combat to get around the battlefield. But she just doesn't leave. And especially maybe if the party did manage to go and wipe out every worshiper of hers, she may not know.
Yeah. No, that's, well, oh man, that brings up a big question. If you're a god, a lesser god, and people start wiping out your followers, I feel like you'd feel something, right? Like your power waning or something along those lines.
Don't know.
Don't know either, but either way, I think you're right. I think the way to play it off is that she's arrogant. She doesn't think this is going to be the end of her, so she's going to stick around and try and take you out if it means dying for a season, because she'll just come back and be able to restart her plans. The last one is she can telepathically communicate with any number of creatures at once if they're on the island, and the effect lasts until she stops concentrating on it or until she leaves the island or uses a different layer action. That one's more like a regional effect than a layer action.
These layer actions aren't crazy. They're definitely not like heavy combat stuff.
No, I think it's just the teleport one that feels like it changes anything up. So just a lot to this in a good way. I mean, mm-hmm. just the three phases, the ability to kind of bring them back as well, and like to make that framing the fight is that this might not be the end unless you fully take out the followers or whatever method you want to introduce in comparison here. But it leads up to such a great like ending you killed me monologue. You know, like before she dies, just delivering this speech of like, I'll be back again, you know, and if this was, you know, maybe like we structure it where midway through the campaign, you have this fight and then it's about fighting cultists, tracking down the cultist. I mean, that could be its own arc itself, you know, almost kind of tells the party like, oh, I'll be back by winter unless X, Y, and Z. It'd almost be interesting. I could see setting up a mini campaign where you start the campaign with this fight. Like, this is the very first thing you do with your high level characters. And then it's all about tracking down the cultists. And like, that's the entire campaign is trying to find them. And they're of varying power levels as well. As scary as she is, a couple high level casters can be pretty darn scary as well for final boss fights.
Sure. And narratively, I worry that would lack tension. you start with like this crazy three phase boss fight of literally killing a god. And then it's like, all right, let's go hunt down the cultists. Like if the cultists were stronger than the god.
Like, they're not stronger by themselves, but they are stronger in it's that idea again of her potentially coming back. I feel like if you structure it from that perspective, it's like, oh, we get to not only deal with that again, but potentially even stronger. And maybe that's what she says as well, is like, next time I come back, I'll be, if you kill me now, I'll only come back stronger, blah, 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 stuff like that.
Yeah. And the lore, it does go into that, where if that happens, like this is her in her weakened form due to like this, the different gods.
Right.
Fighting. I don't know the specifics of it, but yeah, it's basically, if she is reborn, it's reborn in her true form. It's just a bigger problem.
Right. So to me, it's like, it's more of like giving the teaser, right? It's like, hey, this is the easy fight. And that to me is where the tension comes from, is knowing that like, oh no, it's only going to get worse. Now, again, not saying that her cultists are specifically stronger than her, but they do have different ways of gaining strength that can still be scary. There's no reason that you can't have really high level cultists in groups who have hired people who've used their power to do other things. I mean, depends on how long you want this campaign to go on for, but you could think of them. Yeah, maybe the fight is less about killing this cultist by itself, but also the fact that they are gaining followers for her and continuing to spread her influence, less of the physical side of, we need to go in and just murder a bunch of people, and how do we figure out how to dethrone this god in their eyes.
Right. So to talk about the phases of the fights as a whole, and I mean, we kind of talk about this as like just a really great example of a multi-phase boss fight. I want to kind of talk through that arc and why I love it so much.
Sure.
And I kind of hinted at this as we were going, but so you start out in the first form, and it is a really weak, underwhelming form. Like I said, if you're doing music, doing mood lighting, anything like that, just keep everything really subdued, quiet. Make her seem really uninterested and almost bored with this, and die pretty easily without much of a fuss, which is what will happen. Just weaken the party a bit, and everyone's just kind of like a little weirded out, a little off-putted by why this is kind of dissonance there, what you're expecting and what you got. And then she bursts into the second form, and the music flares up, and it's everything about the second form is huge and bombastic. You have this 10-foot tall ice lady who's hitting you with ice morning stars and hurling ice stars as big as you, and cone of colds going off, and the ice stasis and mephits exploding everywhere. And all of this is just crumbling her fortress down around her and destroying everything. And she goes absolutely crazy trying to kill the party and end this, you know, player up the rage in her. Because there's not a whole lot of spell casting and, like, you know, careful plotting things like that. And you finally get her down, probably after getting hurt a decent bit, and the party's thinking it's over. And then there's one more fight where everything is condensed down to just the true essence of who she is. This little, you went from this crazy thing going on to this just really condensed down, this 3-foot diameter ice diamond floating. And it's a really simple fight. You have the Blizzard Veil and you shoot polar rays. And there's not much more to it, but that's actually a really, really difficult challenge to overcome in D&D at the level this is fought at, when you're already hurting. And it's this race to down her before she downs you, because not much is stopping her from attacking and dealing, you know, 14-ish damage every turn, 28 damage probably, every single turn. And it's just this
again, those legendary actions, yeah.
Yeah. And just this desperate struggle to figure out this simple puzzle as she's just beat you down with just the essence of who she is. And hopefully you kill her before she kills you. And then it's finally over.
It really reminds me of that Dark Souls Sister Frida.
Sister Frida?
Yeah, Frida. When the ashes are too, the flame alighteth. Like that idea of like the third health bar, you never expect that. It's two, okay, you're kind of ready for that. But the third, and I think it matches that kind of energy, like you just said as well. I'm sorry, if you don't know this fight, it's like a DLC in Dark Souls 3, and it's my favorite boss fight of any video game absolutely ever.
It was a really cool one. And very difficult. But.
Yeah, but it has that kind of that wave that I think you talked about, like the first one being easier, kind of subdued, the second being like all out wild, and then the third one being like almost reserved, calculated, the like, okay, this I'm putting a stop to. I'm like, I've regained my focus, and it's it's over. I'm not messing around anymore. I'm not freaking out. It's just, you need to die. I'm tired.
Yes. So that's what makes it a good example. And as we were saying, you could rip this and just put this in your game if you're not running Icewind Dale. Tweak some things a little bit, or just use it as a structure to make other 3-4 boss fights.
Yeah, and this is the only time I've ever seen this method of just using three different stat blocks and saying, you know, first, second, third form. And
right.
It's, I think it works pretty well. It's smooth. I mentioned earlier, I think it's better than the mythic phase of what you see in Odysseys of Theros, where it's, that makes it basically like, oh, you get back to full health, but it's the same exact fight again with like one tiny little tweak.
Right. This is actually feels cleaner. Because like reading like the mythic, how those worked, and you know, like a couple paragraphs of explanation of how that works and everything to like, yeah, ultimately not have too big a difference. Where this was like really obvious. She just transforms from one stat block to another, to another.
Right. Right. I'm now imagining if all the mythic ones just had this, where it was like first form, second / mythic form, whatever you want to call it. And then it's like, yep, right. I get it. I get it. It all makes sense. Did we already do the thing? We're done. We're just done. You said Bardley. We're good. What more do we need?
Well, that was like we officially focused on Bardley last episode.
Oh,
I guess it doesn't matter if we do it twice.
Yeah, use Bardley.
Yeah. I say we talked about music a lot, and a really good way to do that is Bardley. Yes. We both Jared and I use it as DMs. Yes. It allows you to make kind of custom and tailor playlist in there. It has an intensity option. You could pick like what you're doing, where you're at, and it kind of crafts the music to it. It's a really cool, easy, intuitive way to do it, and an easy way to ramp up the tension, as we kind of were talking about.
Oh, that's true. The intensity would be so perfect there. You find the fight and you keep it at one, move it to midway, and then move it all the way up. That's like, it's all done for you.
Yep. Yeah. It literally has like an intensity slider.
Yeah.
It's not a slider, but same idea.
So you can use the code MNM50 to get 50% off your first 3 months. And yeah, check it out. Really been very happy with Bardley.
Mm-hmm. And if you're playing online, it could generate a link and you give it to your players, who then go to that website and they'll hear whatever you are having at play, and they have control over their own volume and stuff like that. So you're not dealing with Discord bots, which could be kind of buggy and not always the most intuitive.
And just randomly leave in the middle of your fight and you're like, wow, I'm so glad I used this Discord bot. Thanks. So thank you so much for watching. Thanks to our patrons as well. Ed G, Muddle 8, Brian H, Craig A, Isaac M, Luca L, Jeff W, Star Shinobi, Vincent M, Bob F, Joe P, Rick D, Sensitive D20, Tyler S, Gray, Barents, Adam A, Rob K, and Gray. If you enjoy and want to support the show, you can head on over to monstersofmulticlass.com/support. You can join our Patreon as well as see our other affiliates. But on our Patreon, you'll get early access to episodes most of the time, usually a Tuesday release compared to our now Friday release for the videos. And you can see other things like campaign notes, campaign diaries, and so on and so forth. So check that out, and thank you all again.
And as always, thanks for watching.